It's 12 o'clock, and you're in tune to KZSU Stanford. And welcome to another edition of the Lunch Special.
Bank hour, though it may inspire in some of you males out there, because we're going to have some very interesting and exciting music. It's the Bert Hale show that portentous music is ushering in from the bowels of the Memorial Auditorium here at Leland Stanford Junior University. It's a show, but we're not going to show anything, but there'll be a lot to hear. And we hope that you can put your socks back on after you find them blown off in a few minutes by this great Wagnerian stuff, which is coming on. And it's to keep you on the edge of your chairs. Anyway, here is Bert Hale.
And welcome to another edition of the Lunch Special. First of all, I'm in the Witness Protection Program, and we don't use last names around here, so that's not really my last name. And second of all, you're hearing the voice of Professor Emeritus of Political Sociology, I believe, Charles Dreckmeyer. Charles, welcome to KZSU.
Well, thank you. It's really political science.
But political science. I'm sorry. Yeah, well, I should have known that.
I don't have delusions of grandeur. It's just a science.
It is wonderful to have you here. We got led to you, my producer and I, by your son, Peter, who happens to be the mayor of Palo Alto, which I know you know.
Yes, I'd heard that. We refer to him as the Burgermeister.
Very cool. Did you call him that when he was a kid, too?
Yes, he's always been mayor of something or other. I have some stories about him, but I promise not to tell them.
He's probably listening. He's close enough to do that, so you might want to be careful about that. You taught here from the mid-50s, is that correct?
From 58 until 98, 40 years.
That's an amazing career.
Well, it seemed amazing at the time. Now, looking back, it certainly doesn't seem like 40 years. I actually started out in sociology and moved into political science. I taught in both departments for a couple of years and got tired of being on everybody's library committee, so convinced political science to take me on full time. And they needed somebody to teach the history of political ideas, which is my what I like to do. Sociology isn't terribly interested in the history of ideas, but political science then did have a faculty that cared about such things. I don't know that that's the case anymore. We're sort of moving toward ethics.
I definitely would like to get your take on today's world, but that's going to have to be later on in this hour. Why don't we go back and start at the start. Tell me about your German background.
Well, that's the reason for the Wagner. I thought we'd talk about some of the ambiguities of culture by way of Richard Wagner. If you watched Lieutenant Lewis on the Masterpiece Mystery last night, you saw a bust of Wagner, and there was a lot of Wagner music sort of off and on in the course of that program. He, as you might remember, some of you, was the associate of Lieutenant Morse when he was just Sergeant Lewis. Now he has become the Wagnerian, and he is putting down his assistant, who is more enamored of popular music, just as Lieutenant Lewis had been in his earlier relationship. It's an interesting problem. Wagner gets it from all sides. There's a famous Bernard Shaw essay called The Perfect Wagnerite, in which he sees the Ring cycle as a critique of capitalism, of late capitalism. The story begins with the theft of the gold from the Rhine Maidens by Alberich, who is the Nibelung of the title Ring of the Nibelungen. And he can only have power if he renounces love. And so we get this tension right from the beginning. And in about 5 minutes, we'll come to a point where Brunhilde is going to have to be consigned to the flames, not directly, they'll only surround her, by Wotan, the head god. And we'll see there some very, very disturbed personalities. I saw a little of this in my own family. My father was born in this country, but didn't speak any English until he was 13 years old, a little German community up in central Wisconsin. And I still, I think, never learned the word for onions. It was always Zwiebel, which isn't even quite good German, but there was this this kind of removed nationalism, German nationalism. My grandfather had been in the German, what was it called, not the merchant marine, but something like that, in order to escape Bismarckian draft conscription, and sailed the China Seas, where he actually spent a lot of time sitting on Muslims in what was then the Dutch East Indies, who were on their way to Arabia, Saudi Arabia. Well, I guess it wasn't Saudi then, but for the annual Hajj that was necessary if you could make it for your performance as a good Muslim. And the storms would come up, they'd try to throw themselves overboard, and my grandfather, who really wasn't very big, would have to sit on them to prevent this kind of early form of jihad gone wrong. And he came to this country, was an engineer, worked for the railroad in Wisconsin, and he came from northwest Germany near Bremen, and he married there a Matilda Wegener. We always thought the name was Wagner, actually, but the christening shows that the name was actually Wegener. And her sister joined them not long after they were married. Sister had been the Kaiser's seamstress. She sewed monograms on the silk underwear of the Kaiser. She went to Holland with that entourage, and then eventually came to this country, to Wisconsin, married my grandfather. But there was this double loyalty which really tore the family apart in both world wars, actually. Germans weren't interned the way Japanese were, but at least Berlin, Wisconsin was for a time pronounced Berlin. I guess that was the one concession that was made. But that this kind of divided self was characteristic of my family, I think, saved in part by the Scottish side, my mother's family. My grandmother always voted for Norman Thomas, but she said, don't tell anybody about that. She said, it's a kind of mild socialism. And the rest of them, she said, they're kind of fanatics, and they were terribly right-wing, my mother, although the daughter of this emancipated woman didn't even cash her Social Security checks. And this was a kind of suffocating situation for anybody who really wanted something more than small town Wisconsin. By the way, we lived in Beloit, which is on the Illinois line, and quite an industrial city. But it was music that that really brought me out of that situation into a larger world, and I'll always be grateful for that. Now, I think Bert has this idea that somehow if we bring along our music, it will reveal something about ourselves that maybe words can't manage as well. Mm-hmm. So I will ask him to talk a little about that after we hear some more from Richard Wagner. The Wotan that you hear is Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, so it's not a... it's not a recent recording. This is the Magic Fire Museum. And the head god, Votan, is calling on the trickster god. Every ancient religion had one. Agni for Sanskrit mythology. Odin, Votan, Norse mythology. Hermes, Jupiter for ancient Greek and Roman. And he calls on Loki to light a fire around Brunhilde to protect her. And I'll tell you in a moment why it is she has to be, why he wants her there in the first place.
Okay. We've been listening to Wagner's The Valkyrie, and this is our selection by my guest today, Professor of Emeritus Charles Dreckmeyer from Stanford here. Charles, you speak about that piece some more. You were that was eloquent the way you were explaining that.
Well, it would take a long time to discuss what is a really a 13-hour operation, the ring of the of the Nibelung. What I can say is that now that we can put our socks back on again. And every one of those banks should have one of these.
Shouldn't you put all your clothes back on?
Well, that's why we're on radio. Even though it's called a show, we're not showing.
Well, you asked my producer if we could do it naked, and I said you could if you wanted.
Well, actually, one thing that saved us when we were both teaching, my wife Margo and I at Stanford, we always saved Tuesdays to go off to the free beaches at north of Santa Cruz. Kept kind of sanity. But on the
way, when you say free beaches, you mean nude beaches?
Oh, yes, of course.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. One of them is not free, actually.
Was there more than one?
Oh, there, yeah, about five of them up there.
Wow.
You don't know that?
Well, we've heard there was a couple. I've seen one with binoculars.
Well, you can actually don't need binoculars if you're willing to work your way down the stony path.
Yeah, I don't have a body for a TV. I don't have a face for TV or a body for it, so I'm a little self-conscious about that.
Oh, well, anyway, yeah, music is sort of, I guess, represents more than almost any other experience the feelings that are a large part of us. And I was a little taken aback to read in the New York Times yesterday an article on how many young people are taking something called Adenol. It's a metafetting
methamphetamine?
No, it's not that. Just amphetamine combination to increase their concentration and to subdue their feelings. And I thought, really, it's sad that it's come to that, but evidently this is how you handle attention deficit problems these days. Evidently, almost 10% of young people ages 18 to 22 take these drugs, these stimulants. But evidently you can end up with sores in your mouth and sores at the other end from just sitting so long doing all this heavy work. Meanwhile, the feelings tend to get lost. The music is important. It's in some cases it's a salvation. Last Thursday I go to Avenidas, the kind of old people's entertainment center in Palo Alto, for the $1 movies. You can go to if you can spend $2, but it was something called The Soloist, which I didn't know anything about. It's a true story about a Los Angeles Times reporter who finds a lost soul playing on two strings of a violin under one of the bridges in L.A. There are 60,000 homeless people there, and he's one of them. And even with that limited violin, the reporter, columnist, actually, is able to detect a real talent. He talks about this man on the radio, and a woman sends in a cello that she can no longer play because of her arthritic fingers. And he demonstrates a really remarkable talent. Turns out he'd actually been to Juilliard and dropped out in his second year for reasons that soon become clear. He's not completely sane. It's hard. I hate to use labels because all of these dementias and forms of manic depression and whatnot are different. And his left hemisphere of the brain, I think you probably, I think this is what's going on, produced an incoherency. All these unconnected sentences would pour forth so fast. But the right side, the side that gives us our images as opposed to the linguistic side, that right side was functioning so beautifully, but he was unable to really pursue a professional career because of the obstructions coming from that which was taking place on the other side of the brain. And I think listening to music like this is very chromatic, Wagnerian music. You get a sense of a kind of struggle that's going on in the 19th century bring a kind of opening of sensation that music had not really, despite Berlioz and some of the earlier contemporaries of Wagner, had not been able to achieve. It's really remarkable, and I hope that more and more people will listen to this. I was going to chastise KZSU for not playing more classical music, but when I turned them on this morning, I was immediately confronted with the Bach Chaconne, which is about as classical as you can get. But there's always room for more of this, and I think it's important that the feelings which tend to get kind of submerged in our kind of culture, that they be encouraged with this kind of experience. It, in my case, it was really more of an emancipation. At age 13, we of course didn't have TV, we didn't have FM, and we didn't have cable or any of that, but the Metropolitan Opera was on Saturday afternoons, and I always listened to that. I don't know where the initial inspiration came from, but I sent off to the Chicago Lyric Theater, the opera was called that, for tickets to Aida. And unless my memory has failed me again, that wouldn't be too surprising. I think they actually had an elephant on the stage, but I was never quite the same after seeing that. It just opened a world for me.
You're saying you got to go to Chicago and see that performed?
See that performance, yes. I went down on the bus and came back on the milk train all by myself.
It really changed your life, huh?
Well, yeah. It was an experience that I knew those things were out there, but in these limited opportunities of Beloit, Wisconsin, there really wasn't much to allow one to really get deep into this part of one's psyche, if you can call it that.
Mm-hmm.
There's Wagner's own life. He was kind of a rascal, not a good example of the finest German art as far as his personality was concerned.
This music has really, really moved you. I could tell that you've literally studied it to the point where you ended up a political scientist, but you know more about this stuff than I know about the blues, and that's a whole other world. But what I'd like to do, Charles Drechmeier, Professor Emeritus of Political Science, before we get too far removed.
But not yet dead.
Is a little bit of history on you here at Stanford. You got here in the 50s, and you and your wife both taught here.
And the twins, Dionysio twins, practically every week. And they arrived just before a general on an inspection tour came by. And
you're not supposed to have cookies,
not
right?
Supposed to have cookies, no. You have to have a blanket on your bed off of which a dime can be bounced. That's the kind, that's mm-hmm. what the army is. But anyway, I went from Arkansas to the outskirts of Birmingham, where I experienced the problems of civil rights firsthand. So I was invited when I got to Stanford to be on several discussion groups, panels, because of that experience way back in the 40s. And from there to Camp Joseph, Camp Lee, Virginia, where they trained band units, and then finally up to Camp Kilmer, which is the port of embarkation. And the USO provided tickets for concerts, symphonic concerts and operas and legitimate theater, free tickets. You just go into Times Square and pick up your tickets. There wasn't much demand for them, and I could always find something. And that's where I got immersed in some of this Wagnerism.
Coming back to your roots at that point, huh?
Yes, in a sense it was. It was a fascinating time. I don't begrudge that Army experience at all. I met people that I'd never met before in my life from different parts of the country that turned out to be just as interesting as the Middle West.
Not to, just for time's sake, I'd like to jump ahead a little bit. You wound up here at Stanford in 1958, you mentioned, right?
That's right.
And it wasn't political science right off the bat, but you ended up in the political science department, right?
That's right. In my third year, I had a Carnegie fellowship to go to Harvard Law School for a year to study the whether the case method could be applied to the social sciences. So I was gone for third year, which allowed me to turn my my dissertation into a book, which you really have to do if you're going to get tenure. And I had planned, I had worked with Talcott Parsons and Carl Friedrich and Louis Hartz at Harvard, and it was possible, actually I had, to go back a few years, we're going in the wrong direction, I think. I taught at Boston University after I got my MA at Columbia in history, and was there for a couple of years, decided maybe I should apply for a Fulbright and go someplace, go to the place that's so far, farthest away that I could probably never afford to go there myself. I applied to go to India and wrote this book on ancient Indian political thought, Sanskrit and Pali thought. Buddhism is in there too, although the Buddhists were not particularly political, but just the fact that they weren't makes the rest of the book look a little more interesting, as you see the struggle between these castes, priestly and warrior castes.
And you spent how long in India?
I was there for a year.
That's amazing. This is back in the 50s, 60s?
This is 53, 54.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Had the British left yet?
Well, the Brits were still hanging around, and I was in Madras State, which is a prohibition state. The British were allowed special alcohol permits because they were perceived, all of them, as being alcoholics. Roger Palachari himself, who the governor, was a prohibitionist, so you had to get these special permits, and they valued me because I could use my permit to help them with their gin, so I got invited to all those parties. But the British had been gone, yes. Gandhi was dead. And,
okay. I was going to ask if he was there when you were there, but he'd been assassinated.
Yes, there was a lot of tension between
Muslims,
India,
and Hindus.
Yeah, because the northwest broken off to become Pakistan. Mm-hmm. Actually, there were two parts. Bangladesh was then East Bengal, and actually it was the same country for a few years, but there were some unfortunate foreign policy decisions in the United States in which the country was aligned with Pakistan, which made foreigners, especially Americans and the British, very unpopular. And one night I was on a train going from Madras down to the tip of India, and suddenly the train stopped and I could hear voices outside, a lot of shouting. It was around midnight. And I was being pushed back by my fellow travelers in what was called the between second and third class. There would be these big boards that you'd pull down from the side, and you'd put down your blanket and roll up in that. And people were covering me with their blankets and sitting in front of me, and then I realized I was being shielded from these young Indians with blood in their eye who were coming on. Any Americans, any British here?
Wow.
No, I haven't seen any. And so I survived that. But
they saved your life.
Well, I suppose at least they saved a beating up. That's the only time I really felt threatened. I enjoyed being in the South because most, there's 13 languages in India. And the four southern languages don't like the idea of being sort of coerced into learning Hindi. They'd rather stay with English so you could communicate with more people in the South.
And this is an amazing experience you had in India. This is after your wars, after your army service, and before you you've become a professor. You started teaching, but
yeah, and then I went back to Boston University for a couple of years, and in that fourth year, I started my graduate work at Harvard, where they had a program for students who could find three or four professors to sponsor them, and they'd allow you to put your own PhD program together. And I did that with Parsons and three others. It worked out very nicely. It was just what I wanted. And I started a dissertation going to be on psychoanalysis and its effect on general social theory, kind of modest undertaking.
I was going to say, that's kind of deep stuff, man.
But after a couple of years there, after I had several years as Parsons' research assistant, I had a phone call from the chair of the Department of Sociology at Stanford. Some friends of ours were already here, William McCord, Bud McCord and his wife, and they helped engineer this. And Parsons had gone out that year to the Center for Advanced Study, and he wrote a letter of recommendation. And I said, well, I've got a year off now to write my dissertation. I don't know if I should. And they said, well, you know, you just love it out here. It's California. It's Stanford is not far from the ocean, and we're going great guns now. Been kind of a playboy school up until then, but Philip Rhinelander, who was the dean, had a couple of years before started bringing out young people from places like Harvard and Columbia and Michigan, Wisconsin, to try to make the school into something more than it had been. The where was I? Oh, well, yeah, and the next day I got another telephone call from McGeorge Bundy, who was dean at Harvard.
Whoa!
One of the early neocons.
Yeah.
And he said, it's just come to my attention that you haven't signed the oath to uphold the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And I said, no, I've taught 4 years at BU. Nobody ever mentioned that. And I don't sign oaths, and I don't like the idea of teachers being singled out. I don't intend to sign it. And anyway, I've decided to go to Stanford. I'm leaving. So
that helped me solidified make up my mind.
Yeah.
That helped you make up your mind.
Right.
And by this time, you were married to your wife.
Yeah, and our baby started coming in 64 with Nadja, who is now a counselor and social worker in Chico, where she went to school.
You have two sons and a daughter, and your son Peter is the...
He's the middle one.
Okay, and he's the mayor of Palo Alto. We've had him on this show. He's a wonderful kid.
Well, he's been evidently a good environmentalist. And
He sure is.
He has an enthusiastic following.
Part of that Tuolumne River Trust. He's the director of it, right?
Well, a regional director, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah. And he would like to devote more time to that, so he's not going to run for city council again, which is kind of too bad.
Well,
and he's got this new baby who's only 3 months old now.
And so you finally force him to have a kid, huh?
I think he's alluding to something we talked about earlier. Which will go unsaid.
Okay.
Yeah.
What I'd like to jump to is your participation. You just talked about how you were slowly getting politicized. I love that part you talked about, not signing any oaths. So life had its way of kind of pushing you into certain directions, because when you got here, the Vietnam War started raging after you'd been here for 6 or 7 years.
Well, I had no relation to the beginning of the Vietnam War.
Well, that's good you mentioned that, because there was some rumors going around. No, I'm kidding. And you were advisor to a one David Harris.
Yes, he is a singular David Harris. One of my favorite people.
Thank you. And he became a true hero here to this day, because he was the student body president, and he stood up and burned his draft card like a lot of other students did on the front steps here at Stanford. And they put him in prison for 2 years for doing that.
Yeah. Well, he's...
What did that do to you?
It was just too close to home. You know, really, I
felt it brought the war right to your front doorstep. Right, put it in your lap, didn't it?
Well, you know, there were a number of experiences. Another student who was very close to me was the assassin of Allard Lowenstein, who was a junior dean at Stanford and gone off to work in the South with SNCC. And there was so much going on that I sometimes I didn't know whether I was coming or going. In the old days, we had an academic council, which was really representative of the faculty, everybody who was on the academic council. But I think the administration decided that the faculty didn't deserve that much autonomy. So I was appointed to, I happened to have been younger members of the faculty who were not known to most of the rest of the faculty, were appointed by the three or four members who were elected to the board, the executive committee of the old academic council. So I was on that council when they were asked to revise the faculty governing body, and the academic senate emerged. And I said at the time, this is, the administration is getting its foot in the door in ways that really defy the old collegiate idea. I see the college as the last of the medieval guilds in which we're self-governing. And so I voted against it, but the others put together this constitution which we live with now. But those meetings, and the first year I was out here, in sociology, I was just, Margot and I were both finishing our dissertations. I had written back to Parsons, and I said, could I turn in my work on India in place of this thing on psychoanalysis? And he said, yeah, if you can get a Sanskritist on the board. So we got Ingalls to be on, the Harvard Sanskritist and philologist to be on that board. And I did manage to get that sort of in shape for a dissertation so that I could stay at Stanford. But in those days, there was no coddling. We didn't get any special time off as beginners, and I was teaching political sociology and sociology of religion and social psychology, which I had never had as a student, psychoanalysis and social structure, bureaucracy, and something else. Did I say political sociology? Mm-hmm. I love doing the sociology of religion. That was fun. But I, you know, we just would go to bed at 4 in the morning and get up at 7. And it was writing those lectures when I was moved several years later to the political science department and teaching the history of ideas, writing 3 lectures a week. That's a lot of work.
And you didn't have a little laptop, did you?
No, we didn't have anything like that.
That was all by hand.
And
right?
I still don't have one.
Good for you. Yeah. And you didn't have cell phones or email or any of that, right?
But I still got a lap, at least.
Well, that's good. That's good.
Cat sits on it most of the time.
Good for you. I'd like to talk about that 1968-69 period. The war protests were heating up here at Stanford pretty heavy. And were you involved in any of that?
Well, I was as much as many others were. I was not a leader. We depended a lot on our undergraduates, I should say, especially the David Harris types. One of the experiences I cherish, because in a sense, it's one of the few battles that I think we actually won. It involved students not at Stanford, but at UC Santa Cruz, and a radical lawyer by the name of Andrew Cohen, who 2 years ago was mayor of Menlo Park. And he said, would you, I'm asking Domhoff from Santa Cruz and you to come down as expert witnesses to talk about why these students who marched down Pacific Garden, whatever it is.
Oh, the downtown street in Santa Cruz.
This big banner that read, up against the wall, Mother Bleepers, or some say, actually it said, I'm going to dance on your graves, Mother Bleepers.
Wow.
And it disturbed the peace. evidently.
Did they get arrested?
They were arrested there because Santa Cruz is not just young, vibrant lefty types. There are a lot of retired admirals and generals and that kind of ilk living right. there, and they didn't appreciate this. So we had gone over to the beach, arriving in Santa Cruz a little early, and here were all these kind of shaggy, naked kids playing volleyball.
Wow.
And the next thing we knew, when we were back in the courthouse, here were these same kids coming in who were the defendants in this case.
Oh.
And Judge May, known as a hanging judge, started off by excusing my wife from the courtroom because she was smoking. And then Dauhoff and I took the stand and talked about how there were basically problems of communication between generations, that that word didn't have the same Oedipal meanings that some of them might have assumed it had, and on and on. And after about 45 minutes or so of our lecturing, the judge, Dauhoff and I, he said, I'm not going to call the jury. I'm excusing the case." And we didn't know until the next day that the judge's daughter had been picked up the night before on a marijuana charge.
Oh, very cool.
Well, it turned out to be good timing on her part.
Yeah, sure. Well, there was a lot of that going on back then. There wasn't this cross-cultural bleed-through, like the younger generation was coming up, and the older day, it was kind of a clash of cultures, wasn't it?
It certainly was, and it was more than cultures that were being clashed sometimes.
Yeah, sure. But did you kind of found yourself in more connected to the younger generation, though, did you?
Well, not necessarily.
Ideology.
Claude Buss in the history department and I were the co-organizers of what was the second Vietnam teach-in in the country. Michigan had beat us to it. And the idea of a teach-in is that you ought to suffer along with the Vietnamese people and the soldiers who were over in Indochina. Mm-hmm. And you had to run for 24 hours. And that was a complete faculty operation. I think there were a couple dozen panels that started out at noon and ran until noon the next day. It was quite edifying. One of the major stars of the anti-administration movement position was Hans Morgenthau from the University of Chicago, professor of foreign affairs and international relations there, and a major opponent of our policy in Vietnam. And he said he would come out and give the major address at 11 o'clock that night. But he said, "It has to be that late because I'm giving some talks elsewhere. But they're on the way to California, so maybe I can make a few stops." And he did arrive on time, but he was an old man then, and kind of beat. I ushered him through the green room in the back of Memorial Auditorium, probably right above where I am sitting at this moment.
It is.
And here were these basically undressed undergraduates wearing nothing much but branches of olive trees and whatnot. They were preparing for a performance of Euripides' Bacchae.
In the theater next door, the Pigott Theater?
They were going to put it on in the Little Theater, yeah.
I
guess it's now called the Pigott. Yeah. Hans Morgenthau kind of reeled, and I caught him, and I said, "Well, just stiff upper lip, Dr. Morgenthau. It'll be over in half an hour." Yeah, but he, with the applause, Memorial Auditorium was filled, and there were hundreds of people outside. We had a public address system. And I think that applause was enough to get him back on his feet. You know, we academics appreciate what little acknowledgement we can get, and when it comes on like that, it will revive almost anything.
Charles, well, I have you here because radio time is so short. We say it's like dog years, and yes, we have about 4 minutes left. While I have you here, do you notice any connections between those days that you remember so well back during the Vietnam era, for lack of a better word, and these days now, where we're in two other wars, and it seems that the policies of the United States might be a lot like they were back then. Do you notice any connections, or how do you see this?
Well, I'll say what I guess just about everybody else says, that this hasn't penetrated the psyches of Americans the way the Vietnam War did, when there was a draft and when the children of the well-to-do could go to the other side of the world and get killed. Now it's, again, the poor who find this as, and increasingly, I guess this will be so, as more and more people are being laid off. Oh, this is Labor Day, isn't it? I forgot to welcome the recently laid off people to this program. But there's always a place for you in the Army, and Obama seems committed to the old Bush policy, which makes me think that the more it changes, the more it stays the same. But there isn't a draft, and that has made a difference. I'm terribly disappointed in Obama, and I think I'm always being told I shouldn't be impatient. But when I see the unwillingness to stand up for Van Jones and people like that, there's so few. You know, when he appointed right-wingers to the Harvard Law Review when he was editor, I could see then what I said is a certain handwriting on the wall. And it's turned out to be that all we have now is stem cell research and a couple of other little things, and I'm afraid we're going to lose again for the 75 years of loss on the health program. Why this should be, why we keep saying we've got the best health care program in the world when we're 23rd or 27th for infant mortality and for life years. It really is a tragedy that a country so rich in resources should be so lacking in what I wanted to talk about as the failure of feeling in our world, and the need for classical music to help us get at another side of ourselves.
You know, there is so much in you. 1 hour can't even scratch the surface. If at all possible in the near future, would you please come back and do another hour with us?
Well, you've got Paul George here, and he's a lot better.
Well, he's going to talk about labor.
Oh, he is.
Yeah, but because it's Labor Day. But I'd like to have you to come back and talk about
Talk about the leisure class.
No, talk about all that stuff you've been involved in and how it relates to today. Because those words you just spoke were deep and eloquent, and I know everybody listening appreciates that.
Well, thank you for the invitation. And Charles, do you want the mayor to come back, too?
Yeah, we want the mayor to come. Well, as long as he's a mayor or not mayor, it doesn't matter. As long as he's a daddy, and he's a daddy, right?
Well, I've got two other children.
Let's get them. let's make it a family affair.
Why not?
Charles Drekmeyer, I want to thank you so much for coming down today. And normally I ask people what their email address is in case people want to get a hold of them, but you don't have one. So if people want to get a hold of you, they can contact your son, the mayor of Palo Alto, Peter Drekmeyer, right?
Well, if you still got a phone book, I'm listed there.
Oh, okay. Charles Drekmeyer in the Palo Alto phone book.
Happy
Charles.
Birthday,
oh, and happy birthday.
Oh, thank you.
Definitely happy birthday.
It's going to be difficult now being 60 years old.
I hear you. I hear you. But and please do come back soon, okay?
Thank you.
Thank you. It's been another edition of Lunch Special. KZSU, Stanford.